He didn't run. He didn't hide. He just sat there and asked if it was self-defense. At a Texas high school track meet, one student lay dying and another stayed behind with a knife and a question. This is the real case of Carmelo Anthony, a 17-year-old honor student now at the center of a national firestorm. In this true crime investigation, I follow the facts through courtroom arguments, racial outrage, a $500,000 fundraiser, and a graduation scandal. This isn't just a murder story. It's a story about manipulation and how we decide who deserves justice. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Stabbing at the Track Meet. I remember the footage first. It was a cloudy Tuesday in Frisco, April 2nd. You could hear the buzz of the track meet echoing across the stadium. Teams in maroon, parents with folding chairs, coaches with clipboards. No one thought they were walking into the middle of a homicide. Carmelo Anthony wasn't wearing a jersey. He wasn't competing. He wasn't even from Memorial High School. He was sitting alone in the stands, in the section reserved for Memorial athletes. Quiet, hoodie pulled up, hands in his lap. That's when Austin Metcalf walked over. Austin was a Memorial student, a track runner, 17, confident, athletic, loud in the way popular high school boys are. Witnesses say he told Carmelo to move. Maybe he was joking, maybe not. But what we do know is this. Carmelo responded with one sentence. "Touch me and see what happens." And then it happened. There was a brief exchange, seconds long, words we may never fully know. And then Carmelo reached into his waistband. He pulled out a knife and drove it straight into Austin's chest. Just once, but that was all it took. Austin staggered back. Blood started to pour. He collapsed right there. On the track, people screamed. Coaches ran. A parent called 911. And Carmelo, he didn't run. He stood still. He didn't speak again until the officers arrived. When they did, the words he said were strange, chilling even. He asked, "Can this be considered self-defense?" That was his first thought. Not panic. Not tears. Self-defense. They cuffed him and walked him out. He didn't resist. Later that night, police recovered the knife. A single-edged folding blade. For inches, the stab wound had punctured Austin's heart. He was pronounced dead at the hospital. He never made it to senior prom. Never made it to graduation. By sunrise, the headlines had already started. High school stabbing in Frisco. Teen charged with murder. Was it bullying? Or something worse? But for those first few hours, there were no protests. No viral videos. Just grief. A locker left untouched. A stadium forever changed. As a journalist, I have covered shootings. I have seen race riots. I have reported from courtrooms. But nothing felt like this one. Because this wasn't a mass shooting or a gang fight. This was two boys, two students, two lives, colliding over a seat on some bleachers. And somehow, only one of them walked away. Chapter 2. Carmelo Anthony. Who is he? I had never heard of Carmelo Anthony before April 2nd. But by April 3rd, his name was everywhere. Not just in news headlines, but in comment sections, TikTok threads, and fundraising platforms. Some called him a monster. Others called him misunderstood. But most people were just confused, because the boy charged with murder didn't fit the mold. He was not failing in school. He wasn't in a gang. He wasn't violent on paper. He had a 3.7 GPA. That part stunned people. He was on track to graduate. But it wasn't just his grades. It was how he carried himself. Teachers said he was quiet, polite, not popular, not disruptive. Some said he kept to himself. Others said he was anxious. But no one saw this coming. Except maybe him. After the arrest, I started looking into his record. No juvenile priors. No expulsions. One disciplinary referral, for skipping class. That's it. So why did he bring a knife? That was the question prosecutors couldn't let go of. And neither could I. It wasn't just that he brought a weapon. It was that he used it. Without hesitation. One stab. Direct to the chest. Lethal. I found out later that the knife wasn't found in his backpack. It was on his person, folded, hidden, ready. That's what the state focused on. Premeditation, intent, Why carry a blade to a school event unless you think you'll need it? But his defenders saw something else. They pointed to his history, said he had been bullied, said he had been followed before. They described a boy on edge, trapped, waiting for the next confrontation. So who was Carmelo really? A scholar? A victim? A killer? Or something harder to define? I kept digging, pulled his school records, interviewed two former classmates. Both said he wasn't the kind of kid who fought back. But both also said this: he had been different lately. More tense, more alert, more quiet than usual. One girl told me he had once written an essay about justice, about how some people snap because they feel like nobody's listening. That essay didn't make it to the yearbook, but I read it, and it chilled me, because in his own words, Carmelo believed that sometimes people choose violence not because they want to, but because it's the only language they think the world will hear. And maybe that's exactly what happened. Chapter 3. The victim's name was Austin. Austin Metcalf, 17, Memorial High School, varsity track athlete, son, friend, brother, dead in under 60 seconds. We say victims' names in headlines, but they don't always feel real. Not until you sit down with their family. Not until you walk through the quiet of their empty bedroom. Not until you hear a father trying to explain why his son will never come home. I met Scott Metcalf 5 days after the stabbing. He didn't want to talk at first. But when he did, it wasn't rage I heard in his voice. It was pain. He told me about Austin's sense of humor, how he loved the track, how he would come home sweaty and starving after every meet, how he made straight B's and wanted to go to college. He also told me about the last text Austin ever sent. It just said, "Done warming up. About to start. Love you." That was April 2nd, at 4:12 p.m. By 4:19, he was bleeding out on the field. Students described Austin as popular but not mean. One girl said he was the kind of guy who would sit with you at lunch if he saw you alone. But others gave a more complicated picture. One sophomore said he was loud sometimes, like he could mess with people, but it was never serious. Another said he didn't like people in his space. If you didn't belong in the team area, he'd say something. Those small things start to matter when tragedy hits. Was Austin defending team space? Or was he asserting dominance? Was it a joke that went bad? Or a power move that pushed Carmelo too far? The surveillance video didn't capture the full audio. We have no exact record of every word spoken between them. Only what Carmelo reportedly said. "Touch me and see what happens." And then it did. At his vigil, Austin's teammates wore black and gold. One of them, a freshman, collapsed crying as they played a song he liked. His mother couldn't speak. His father barely stood. But the silence that hung over that stadium told its own story. A story about a kid who was fast, bright, and full of promise. A story that didn't deserve to end in blood on the track. A story that's now buried beneath 100 angry headlines. Because every time someone says Carmelo, someone else is quietly whispering Austin, trying not to forget the boy who didn't walk away. Chapter 4. A trial by social media. I didn't find the story. The story found me. It started with a hashtag, then a link, then a flood. In less than 72 hours after the stabbing, Carmelo Anthony became one of the most talked about names online. But what people were saying, that was the real story. On one side, supporters called him a victim, said he had been bullied, said he warned Austin, said he acted in fear. They posted videos, quotes, screenshots from school chat groups. Most of it was unverifiable, but that didn't stop it from spreading. On the other side, people were furious, said he brought a weapon, said he escalated, said he should not be rewarded. They called him a murderer. They started petitions to block his graduation. They called the fundraiser blood money. And somewhere in the middle, the truth got crushed. The fundraiser on GiveSendGo raised over $500,000. The campaign said it was for legal defense and relocation. But critics jumped in fast. They said the money was being misused. Said the family bought a new home. Said luxury cars were involved. None of it was proven. In fact, local police and the FBI opened investigations into the online rumors. What they found was disturbing. Dozens of fake social media accounts. Automated posts. Coordinated campaigns. Bots. Misleading edits of the surveillance video. Doctored screenshots. A digital wildfire. Fed by people who didn't even live in Texas. This wasn't just a murder case anymore. It was content. It was clicks. It was outrage economy, and Carmelo Anthony, a 17-year-old on house arrest with an ankle monitor, was now the face of something much bigger, something scarier. I tried to follow the threads. Each one took me further from the school and deeper into the algorithm. One TikTok claimed Austin had attacked first. It was false. One YouTube video called Carmelo a revolutionary hero. It had over 1 million views. Another said the stabbing was part of a gang initiation. Also false. But by then, the facts no longer mattered. What mattered was who you believed, not what you knew. The Metcalf family tried to stay quiet. But eventually, Austin's father spoke to the press. He said, "We are watching the boy who killed our son become a martyr online, while we are left with silence." The district made no public comment. The judge issued a gag order. But the court of public opinion kept running. And in that court, the loudest voices always win. I sat with this chapter for a long time, because I wasn't sure how to report something that wasn't real, but was still shaping reality. But that's the world now. A story can be true. A story can be false. And online, they are given the same weight. And when lives are on the line, that weight becomes deadly. Chapter 5, Race, Law, and the Knife. This is where things stopped being local. Where it stopped being about two boys on a set of bleachers, and started being about the country we live in, because whether people admitted it or not, this case became about race. Carmelo Anthony is black. Austin Metcalf was white. And in a state like Texas, where stand your ground laws and racial tension sit just under the surface, that combination turned this case into a national debate. The prosecution's argument was simple. Carmelo brought a knife. That knife turned a confrontation into a killing. That decision erased any claim of self-defense. Intent followed him to the scene. But his defense told a different story. They said he had been bullied, said he had reason to be afraid, said that when Austin walked toward him, he believed he was in danger, and he reacted. Fast, deadly, but not premeditated. Texas law makes it hard to prove self-defense when a weapon is brought to a nonviolent setting. But there's also room in the law for fear. Reasonable fear. Subjective fear. What would a 17-year-old think in that moment? It's not just about what was done. It's about what was felt. And when you add race into the equation, everything gets louder. And messier. Supporters compared Carmelo's case to others. They pointed to George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. They brought up Daniel Penny and Jordan Neely. They said the media always paints young black boys as threats. They said Carmelo was being punished for surviving. Critics fired back. Said this wasn't about race. Said Carmelo wasn't innocent. Said the victim was white and now being erased. They called it a double standard. Online posts turned into shouting matches. In some circles, Carmelo was a symbol of racial injustice. In others, he was a cold-blooded killer who got sympathy because of his skin color. Neither side was fully right. Neither side was fully wrong. But neither side was listening. The law doesn't move with feelings. It moves with facts. And here were the facts. A teenager brought a knife to a school event. A confrontation happened. A boy was stabbed once in the chest. That boy died. The other boy stayed and asked, was it self-defense? Those facts never changed. But what changed was how people saw them. Through politics. Through pain. Through history. Through fear. I watched the courtroom fill with tension before the hearing. Not just legal tension. Cultural tension. Because this case wasn't just about a knife. It was about the blade we all live on, the thin one between justice and identity, and who gets the benefit of the doubt. Chapter 6, The Graduation Scandal. I got the email the same day it went public. Carmelo Anthony had met the academic requirements to graduate. He wouldn't be walking across a stage, wouldn't be wearing a cap and gown in front of his classmates, but he would receive a diploma, privately, somewhere off-site. No ceremony, no applause, just the document. It felt like a quiet decision, but it made the loudest noise yet. The school district released a brief statement. They said a student's academic status is separate from any criminal charges, that the law requires due process, and that Carmelo had passed all his courses. Technically, they were right, but emotionally, it hit like a punch. Austin Metcalf's father called it a betrayal. He filed a formal complaint. He said, "You can't honor the killer while the victim lies in a grave." Online, the backlash exploded. People flooded the district's social media pages. Some accused them of rewarding violence. Others praised the decision as fair and legally sound. Even students were divided. One senior wrote, "He earned the grades. That's all that should matter." Another said, "I don't feel safe knowing he got a diploma while under a murder charge." The real story, the one no one printed, was that the ceremony wasn't a ceremony at all. It took place in a quiet hotel room. Two school officials. No photos. No cap. Just a paper and a pen. Carmelo didn't speak. Didn't smile. He just signed and took the folder. His ankle monitor was still strapped to his leg. The graduation issue revealed something deeper. Something we don't talk about. That justice isn't just about courts. It's about perception. About dignity. About whether people feel heard. To Austin's family, this decision erased their son's death. To Carmelo's supporters, it affirmed that the system could still be fair. And to everyone else, it was a reminder that in America, sometimes justice isn't one story. It's two, told at the same time, and believed by different people. I stood outside Memorial High School the week of graduation. There were balloons, music, smiling parents, and one empty seat in the front row, the seat they left for Austin. That silence said more than any speech ever could. Chapter 7, Justice or Manipulation. This case was never just about the knife. It was about how we choose sides, how quickly we let facts become filters, and how easily the truth can be bent, even when it's right in front of us. By the time the grand jury convened, public opinion was already decided, but not in one direction. It was split, deeply, painfully. One side believed Carmelo acted out of fear. The other believed he planned to kill. And in between those two extremes were people like me, trying to understand, trying to report, trying to make sense of what happened without becoming part of the noise. The grand jury would decide whether to indict him on first-degree murder. That decision still hasn't come down. But whatever happens, the damage is done. Austin is gone. Carmelo is marked. Two families are shattered. And an entire school district has been changed forever. There's a question that has haunted me since day one. What if both things are true? What if Carmelo was scared and still made a deadly choice? What if Austin meant no harm and still triggered the worst possible response? What if no one intended for this to happen, but everyone still played a part? We want our stories simple. Victim, villain, right, wrong, black, white. But real life, especially in America, is not that clean. It never has been. Some say Carmelo manipulated the system, that he used race, used fear, used public sympathy, raised money, got a diploma, and may still walk free. Others say he was manipulated, that the media shaped him into a symbol, that his trauma was used to stir up culture war outrage, that his pain became profit for people who never knew his name. And then there's the manipulation we never see, the one inside all of us, the way we scroll and click, the way we judge without context. The way we decide who deserves mercy and who deserves none. The way we believe the version that makes us feel better, even if it's not the full truth. When I started reporting this story, I thought it would be a tragedy. But what I found was a mirror, a reflection of everything broken in our justice system, in our schools, in our country, and in ourselves. I don't know what the jury will decide, but I do know this. A boy is dead, another is alive, and no matter what the verdict is, we all lost something on that field, something we may never get back.